Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CJSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
Welcome to this week's edition of Latin Waves. On the first part of the show, we speak to progressive economist Robin Hanel about the need for a new Green Deal. And on the second part of the show, we speak to renowned author Vandana Shiver about her new book, Soil, Not Oil, and how biodiversity can help us recover from the economic and environmental crisis. So stay tuned.
Someone who thinks a lot about the role that our society has in reshaping the world we live in is Robin Hanel. He is an economist who has written Economic Justice and Democracy. He's also writing a new book that will address the issues of climate change and how do we address this in a democratic manner. We are very privileged to have Robin Hanel on our show. Welcome to our show, Robin.
Hey, it's great to be on with you, Sylvia.
Now, there seems to be a common agreement that, you know, when we think about food insecurity, peak oil, climate change, the economic crisis, these are things that concern not just North Americans, but these are things that are creating a lot of cultural and political changes worldwide. So let's talk a little bit about how this change occurred, because when we look at Europe, for instance, we see people in France who are actively challenging their government's decisions to impose more structural adjustments. When we look at Latin America in the South, we are seeing people who are standing up and saying, no more. We're not going with the neoliberal model, and we're changing it. We're going to nationalize our banks. We're going to nationalize our industries. And then we come to North America, and we're told, wait, the change has to be slow. We can only do it over time. Is this the case? Do we always have to compromise our own immediate needs to maintain and continue to allow a system that is creating not only hunger, but it's also killing us?
Well, the first thing you mentioned is absolutely true, that the two big crises we face immediately are global in nature. And that does make them more difficult to resolve because it requires, you know, a coordinated global response in order to be effective. One is the greatest global economic sort of collapse and crisis in over 80 years. And anybody who thinks that it's over, that it's been solved, that we are going to grow out of this, is making a terrible mistake. Because the truth of the matter is that the global response of the present leaders, global world leaders, has been not just inadequate, but in many ways terribly counterproductive. So there is no reason to believe that the economic crisis, the global economic crisis, is not going to, at a minimum, simply fester, you know, for years and years and years. And there's a very, very serious possibility that it will actually deepen, that we will actually see unemployment rates rise rather than simply stagnate. And of course, the other problem is the ecological crisis, which is much deeper than just climate change. It's not just the carbon cycle that, you know, human economic activity has thrown dangerously out of balance. There are other major parts of the world ecosystems that, you know, life on the planet, you know, relies on, that human economic activity is put seriously in danger. But climate change and many of those others, are not things that are easy to solve locally. Now, that poses a serious dilemma, you know, for those of us who are aware that these problems are serious and who are aware that those who are running the world right now are doing nothing effective about them. I mean, that's also the story of Cancun. The world made some promising steps towards solving climate change at Kyoto in 1997. But ever since then, the world leadership has essentially taken us backwards, farther and farther away from actually solving the climate change problem, even as the science and the scientists continue to tell us every time they revise their estimates of how serious this problem is and how quickly it's going to materialize and how quickly we need to be responding, their revisions keep telling us the problem is even more severe than we, you know, have told you in the past. We're even more sure of it, and the necessity of, you know, of a rapid response, you know, is even greater. So those of us who understand that and believe that are put in a very difficult situation. The powers that be at the global and national levels, for the most part, with the exception of some governments in Latin America, for the most part, are proving completely incapable or unwilling to respond to these things, or engaging in counterproductive activity. What that means is we have to simply do as best we can in many ways in a local setting, where we do have, you know, greater power to affect outcomes. But it is a serious dilemma, because in the end, we're not going to prevent climate change and many of the other ecological problems by local actions alone. And we're certainly not going to turn around the economic crisis by local actions alone. But at least in the time being, we are left, we're left with few other options. And that is part of the dilemma that we face in terms of being the people who are trying, you know, to solve real problems and make sense out of the world we live in and prevent disasters.
We are told that faced with the economic crisis, the only measure left to us is to cut deficits by immediately cutting the spending the governments have on social services, health, education, housing projects. We haven't seen one of those in Canada since the 70s. Is this the case? I mean, is this really the only option?
No, this is complete right-wing capitalist propaganda. The notion that the European economies can no longer afford decent education systems, decent health care. This is total nonsense. The productivity, the productive potential of the advanced economies today is every bit as high as it was 3 years ago and is significantly higher than it was 30 years ago. That means objectively the advanced economies are capable of providing a more generous and solid, you know, set of social services than at any point, you know, in their past or in human history. So people should put it in terms of, well, what's the productive potential of our economies today? Has it deteriorated? Because that would be the only real reason, you know, that public services would have to decline. So it has to be another answer. And the other answer is political priorities. The wealthy don't want to pay taxes. Therefore, they don't want to fund social services. The wealthy want whatever taxes are being collected to be spent on corporate welfare and militarism, and that's the other reason that there is less money available for the public services and what's generally referred to as the welfare state that the United States can no longer afford, Social Security, Medicaid, the welfare state and programs that Europe can no longer afford, that somehow they could afford in the 1970s, that makes no sense at all. People really need to just sort of dig beneath, you know, go straight to the heart of the matter and realize it's entirely a matter of relative of priorities. Now, the dilemma we face is, right now, the people who have access to power about government policies and priorities are precisely the wealthy and the corporate. They have more power relative to the rest of us than they have had for a very, very long period of time. Corporate control of the media, corporate control of the messaging, and globalization that has essentially effectively disempowered all of the counter-institutions like unions and social work programs in the advanced economies. All of this has essentially, you know, produced a dramatic change in political power at the global level between corporations, the wealthy, and the rest of us. Therein lies the problem that the countervailing forces that we used to be able to rely on to protect us to some extent have weakened considerably, and there's no point in whining about it. There's no point in sort of sitting around wringing our hands saying Obama's the traitor. Obama works for the other team. We elected change, we voted for change, and what we got is continuation of somebody who's serving the same powerful interests that we're opposed to. So there's no point in whining about it anymore. Essentially now the task is how do we regain power, because that is the only way we're going to turn things around.
Not only did he keep the taxes that Bush had given to the rich, but he's also given the greatest bailout that, you know, Americans have ever seen, I mean, in the history of America. But talking about that...
That's right. There's no bailout for homeowners. There's bailout for the big Wall Street banks. And the tax cut for the wealthy, I mean, a great majority of the American public at this point does understand. We have been had. That a very small elite has essentially, you know, pulled off an incredible coup at our expense. Clearly, this president, you know, is not what we voted for in 2008.
You know, what about those people in the audience who are still saying, "Well, look, wait a minute. We live in a globalized economy, and we have to do things that sometimes hurt a great number of people, but in the long run, will make us better." This has been something that's been fed to us in the universities, in our classrooms. You know, our professors of economics keep telling us that sometimes governments make tough choices that hurt a lot of people, but in the long run, the majority of the people will be better off. You know, can you talk a little bit about this? Because I am so sick of hearing it.
Yes. Listen, when was the last time the government made a tough choice here in the United States and told the military-industrial complex they couldn't have everything they asked for? When was the last time the government here in the United States made a tough choice and told wealthy taxpayers, you've got to ante up? You have sopped up basically 95% of all productivity gains in the U.S. economy for 30 years, and you're paying less taxes than you did 30 years ago. Yes, government needs to make tough choices. It's not making the tough choices at the expense of the people who are actually controlling the government. Instead, it is telling us to continue to further serve their interests, that they're going to lower living standards for the rest of us for decades to come. Now, let's go to whether the international situation, you know, puts serious constraints on what governments can do. There is a huge difference between what the government of Ireland can do and what the government of the United States or the government of Germany can do. Here's a very simple example. When you're in the middle of the greatest recession in 80 years, what governments in general need to do is run a deficit in order to help stimulate demand to turn the economy around. We need a fiscal stimulus. What fiscal stimulus means is more deficit spending in the short run while we are in the depths of this recession. More fiscal spending and more deficit in the short run to prevent this recession from becoming a worse global depression, which will also further aggravate government budget deficits over the long haul. That's what's needed. Now, the sad truth is the government of Ireland can't do that because they cannot sell bonds without paying now catastrophically high interest rates. The international money managers that Paul Krugman calls the bond vigilantes, they have decided that they won't lend to the government of Ireland except at an interest rate of up around 8, 9, 10%. Well, the government of the United States right now is borrowing at interest rates that are historically the lowest we have faced in decades. So the truth of the matter is the U.S. government is not prohibited by the bond markets from borrowing in order to do what our economy and the global economy needs, which is more fiscal stimulus. We're failing to do that because of a political campaign to get everybody worried about budget deficits now and to essentially insist that that's the problem that needs to be solved. No, the problem that needs to be solved is the unemployment rate. And all this nonsense about budget deficits in the United States is essentially preventing our government from doing what we need it to do. Now, in the case of Ireland, what that government needs is the European Commission to come to its rescue. The European Commission, the European Central Bank, the government of Germany, first of all, they can stare down the bond vigilantes. They have the power. There's an assumption that the world's governments have no power vis-a-vis the international money markets and the international money managers. Well, that is nonsense. That is not true. We had tremendous power to curb those forces through Bretton Woods-type programs when, you know, in the aftermath of World War II. And that's why this kind of nonsense didn't happen then. We had an international economic policy in place that was specifically designed not to let bond vigilantes essentially dictate economic policy to elected governments. Well, in this case, the European Union, the central bank, the European Bank, they need to come in. What Ireland needs them to do, and it's not just Ireland. I'm picking on Ireland because they're one in the news today. But yesterday it was Greece, and tomorrow it will be Spain, and the day after that it will be Portugal, and the day after that it will be Italy. All of those governments can't borrow on reasonable terms. They need the European Union to help them do that. They need the European Union to basically be a co-signer. The way that a parent co-signs a loan for a child or a student, they need a co-signer to bring those interest rates down to reasonable interest rates so they don't have to do the counterproductive thing of increasing the age at which people retire. How insane, when the world's economies are more productive than ever before, that we're being told we can't afford to retire as early as we used to retire. This is nonsense. And there are ways to prevent this. But the ways to prevent this, in some cases, require international governing authorities to intervene and prevent the bond vigilantes from holding a government like Ireland hostage. But the sad thing is, in the United States and in Germany, there's no reason we couldn't have a fiscal stimulus. We are borrowing at rates of interest. The bond markets are telling us they're perfectly happy to lend money to the U.S. government and the German government at historically low interest rates. And what those governments should be wanting to do is borrow a lot of that cheap money in order to engage in a much larger fiscal stimulus, because that's the only thing that's going to pull us out of this recession.
Now, you talk about fiscal stimulus. We need to talk about what kind, because in terms of a well-functioned economy seems to have been always equated with the McMansions or the, I would call, the excesses of a very small elite class. What other things can be considered as a good economy?
Yes.
Or so?
And this is where more spending to get more production, to just produce more environmentally destructive consumption, this is just aggravating the environmental crisis. But there's an answer. There's a way to resolve this seeming contradiction. We can put people back to work making windmills, making solar panels, converting buildings to become more energy efficient. All of that is basically putting us on the path to a fossil fuel-free economy, to a carbon-neutral economy 10 to 20 to 25 years from now. And that's work, and that's production. Or we could put people back to work building more roads to put more cars on, or we could put people back to work building more McMansions for more wealthy people to live in energy-inefficient ways. So, yes, composition matters. It matters what we produce. So one name for this is a Green New Deal, and we need a Green New Deal. But a Green New Deal isn't going to come with a government that allows Wall Street to be in charge of when and where and what we invest. And a Green Deal isn't going to come if governments don't engage in a lot of fiscal stimulus to put people back to work doing these things. And frankly, a Green Deal is unlikely to come in many economies unless there's an international agreement on climate change that essentially establishes strong incentives for governments to pursue this transition to new energy systems and basically a new economic infrastructure.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how this process can take place, because, worldwide we know we have a billion people going hungry. There are 35,000 children dying today because they have no food or hunger-related diseases. So this idea that, several billion people will suffer, where's the majority? It seems to me we're already causing more harm than than alleviating harm. So how do we move these transitions forward without this inevitable cost of sacrificing people's lives to make the way for a better life for the rest of us?
It is perfectly possible to solve the economic crisis and the ecological crisis and at the same time feed all the children on the planet. There is no actual real world sort of trade-off between achieving all those goals. We need to concentrate on two things, and that is identify the programs that will help and make sure that we clearly understand what things will not help. Things that will not help, for instance, are undoing the Social Security system or undoing Medicare in the United States. Those things aren't going to help solve any of the real problems we face. But in addition to sort of being clear about what are the actual solutions and identifying, you know, what those are and distinguishing them from all of these myths about somehow trickle-down is going to save us, because everything you just mentioned about, well, what is it that the other side is saying is going to solve the problems? What they're basically saying is throw more money at the banks, throw more money at the wealthy, give them their tax breaks, don't tax their inheritance, and then somehow they will miraculously do something they have not been doing in the past for over 30 years. The real question, however, becomes, well, how is it that we launch a program that's trickle-up economics and really solving problems? And you're not going to do that without rebuilding powerful movements. And there is the real problem. The real problem is that the center-left, not just in the United States and not just in Canada, the center-left worldwide has essentially become the center-right. Organizations, political parties, the Socialist Party in Spain, the PASOK, sort of Social Democratic Party in Greece, the Democratic Party in the United States, the Obama administration, these are political forces that used to be center-left. They used to fight for making sure that some of the productivity of capitalism actually goes to the people who are working and producing goods and services, and that we have priorities that are socially responsible priorities rather than irresponsible environmental, you know, behavior. Those organizations, those political parties, they have essentially abdicated their traditional role. And we who are farther to the left, who know for sure that the real answer to all these problems is a totally different economic system where you don't have to fight against these guys all the time. We have to do their job to rebuild powerful social movements that are fighting for ways to make capitalism sane rather than insane, at the same time that we need to keep saying, but the real way to solve these problems is the way they're solving them or trying to solve them in Venezuela, in the way that we've always known was a better way than capitalism, and that's through some sort of participatory democratic socialism. So we need to be doing two things, and we need to be doing it, and our organizational resources, you know, are very meager. So we don't have a lot of resources. Our traditional allies have essentially abandoned the field, and yet the necessity of accomplishing sort of a remarkable mobilization of public opinion. But we can see that starting. I mean, the students tripling fees in England. I mean, who would have ever thought that a government could get away with that? Well, they did it, so they got away with it, but at least there are consequences. So we've seen consequences beginning in England. We've seen consequences in Ireland. And there really was no fighting back in either of those countries up until relatively recently. We know in Greece that there's been fighting back. We know that this, you know, most recently in France, you know, there was fighting back. So that's what we have to look for. More and more people are calling for that. People who were sort of supportive of Obama and were saying, well, let's give him a chance, and he's only making the compromises that have to be made. So those people have come to their senses. More and more progressives realize the difficult task we're facing, and a higher and higher percentage of the population is realizing, oh my God, we are in such serious trouble. We really have to think about doing so. We have to try and protect ourselves.
Now, you've been talking about the need to move to a more democratic, a participatory form of socialism where people actually have a say. In the meantime, we are in a system of capitalism that it's in many ways is beyond the capitalist system that was envisioned at one point. It is not a corporate monopoly. But what you're saying is that if we turn back to even a Keynesian model of capitalism where we spend in social services, this can enable us to transition to a more democratic participatory socialism. So how do we do that? And what kinds of priorities are to be part of this transition? If we are investing a Keynesianism model, it means that we're investing public funds. What kinds of things should we be investing in?
Keynesianism can come in different varieties. You can have military Keynesianism. Essentially, that's the way we got out of the last depression. The first person to practice Keynesian economics was Adolf Hitler, because they started their military buildup in the 30s in Germany before the sort of military buildup in England and the United States that came sort of 5 or 6 years later. So how did Germany get out of the Depression? It basically had a government that spent money hands over fists on military, you know, preparations. And the truth of the matter is, for all of the New Deal programs and for all the good they did, they really did not pull us out of the Depression here in the United States. It wasn't until we started the Lend-Lease program where we were cranking up military production and lending it and basically selling it to England before we entered the war in 1941, but selling it them basically to them on credit. That was what finally pulled us out of the Depression here in the United States. But it doesn't have to be that way. I mean, we can have Keynesianism in the form of a Green New Deal instead of military Keynesianism. And one of two things has to happen to the financial sector. It either has to be subjected to serious competent regulation, which was the path that was taken back in the 30s, you know, with financial reform and Glass-Steagall. Or somebody needs to simply say, you know, we've watched this happen over and over again. Free market finance is an accident waiting to happen. If we're going to have capitalism, we're not going to have that kind of capitalism anymore. In which case, you're basically saying that the credit system is going to be publicly owned. You can take over the banks, and you can essentially make that a bailout in lemon socialism for the creditors and the stockholders. You also can essentially appoint managers and say, well, use the same criteria for running your banks. Run them in exactly the same way as the private banks were being run. You can fight for Keynesian programs and fight for a change in criteria. You can fight for community and democratic control over public institutions. And you can fight for spending on the right kind of things instead of the wrong kinds of things. This is a situation that the far left, I have been in the far left for 40 years. This is a situation that I think we have always handled badly. It's very tempting to say capitalism is awful and it's always going to produce these crises. And that's why we need socialism, which is wonderful. It's a question of whether all capitalisms are created equal. And the truth of the matter is they're not. The capitalism of Sweden of 1970 was a far cry and a lot better than the capitalism of the United States right now. And that's always been true. And the left needs to recognize that while we are building a majority support for a whole different kind of economy and doing a better job of explaining how it can work, why it will be better, providing examples of where that can occur both in sort of small situations like in workers-owned co-ops and also in larger situations like, you know, the programs that they're pioneering in Venezuela, at the same time that we're doing that, we have to effectively fight for ways to protect people's lives and protect the environment within capitalism. And lots of the time that means fighting for Keynesianism rather than 19th century sort of Hooverism. I mean, Herbert Hoover economics is what we're getting right now. Sometimes we have to fight for Keynesianism because it's sane, and we can always fight for a more humane, more environmentally protective, and more egalitarian form of Keynesianism, opposed to the interests that would essentially say we don't care about any of that.
Thank you so much for being with us. You have an upcoming book. Tell us about it, and when does it come out?
This is December, and it's supposed to be out at the end of this month. Emmy Sharp is the publisher. The book is called Green Economics, Confronting the Ecological Crisis. It's a book that was written out of desperation because mainstream environmental economics and even a lot of heterodox schools of economics, such as ecological economics, none of them really help people who are concerned about the environment and economic policy figure out how to think about things. The environmental crisis, the ecological crisis, is so serious that we need to gather the nuggets of wisdom and dispel the myths, you know, as best we can until we have sort of a grand synthesis about how to analyze and understand the relationship between human economic activity and the natural environment.
Thank you again for joining us. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You are listening to Latin Waves, a weekly syndicated program. For more information about our program, visit www.latinwavesmedia.com.